is now duly opened, and today we consider mainly two items: the presentation that we are to receive from Transnet Group, as well as the consideration of the minutes of the previous meeting. Having said that, I have received the apologies from the Minister and the Deputy Minister. Today, the National Assembly has a pre-lineup, and therefore they are unable to join us in this meeting. We have received their apologies. I have not myself had an opportunity to meet with the Minister, and my office is busy trying to schedule a meeting so that we can have an audience to also raise some of the concerns which were raised by the honorable members. I'm processing that, and in the near future, I will be meeting with the Minister. I can guarantee that, so that I can highlight those matters. Members, the meeting is open, and I want to take this opportunity at this point to ask the officials of the committee to indicate the apologies that we might have received from other members just before this meeting began, or written messages that we received a few days ago. Amanda?
Thank you, Chair. I have received three apologies, an apology of Honorable Abuskashmi and Honorable Smith, as well as Honorable Debray. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Those are the three apologies that we... Are there any...
Honorable
Chairperson?
Yes, let me put an apology for Honorable Mamro Abelai. He is out of the country attending youth conference in Europe.
Okay. I assume then, Honorable Modi said that there is no internet in Europe, so he is unable to connect virtually. Or maybe she is in a session. Thank you.
She is in a session as we speak.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Modise. That apology is noted. Thank you very much. Yebo, Honorable Mugase.
Chairperson, I just want to point out something here before you take the point of apologies. Chairperson, it looks like it's a norm within the portfolio that you are holding, chairing this committee. And it's a norm in this committee, select committee, that the minister can just send an apology. There's no deputy minister who can stand in and all is well. And we are made to accept these things. I don't know who said it's casting stone that if the minister is not there for a period of time, we as members can just accept and allow the department to continue with the business whilst the political head does not show any interest in the work of his own portfolio. Chairperson is wrong, and it's not for the first time that we are speaking about this. Secondly, Chairperson, it's extremely wrong for you to seek audience on our behalf as a select committee with the minister, requesting him to honor the appointment of the select committee. We need to hold him accountable, and it's our constitutional right to do so. He undermined us from the beginning of this term, and he's still doing that. So it's wrong. He needs to know that he accounts to this select committee, not to the chairperson of the select committee. So I object to your proposal that you are going to seek audience from the minister, for the minister to come. And it's not for you to beg him. He's compelled by the Constitution to come and account to us. It is not up to you, Chairperson. Honestly, we need to look into this. And I'm honestly putting it on the table to say, why do you have to accept the department to come alone without a minister?
Recording in progress.
Why? I'm going to propose that we seek political representation for this from this department before this meeting starts, Chairperson. That will be my submission for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mukause, for that intervention. I note what you are saying, but as you recall, I'm not sure if you were present in the meeting where this matter was raised. And then I was given a full mandate to ensure that in future, the ministers, together with the deputy minister, they must come to this committee, because there has been a trend, as you are pointing out. So it was in that context that I started the process as part of the handover of me as the new chairperson in this committee to engage with the department. So it is in that context. It's not like my own making that I decided on that. But I agree with the points that you are making, because they were seriously raised from the very onset when I came through to this committee, that there's been a trend that the minister and the deputy are never here. And therefore, we are pursuing the matter. We are not begging. We are correct that they are accountable here. We exercise oversight over their offices and their departments. So you are very much correct. But I don't want us to belabor the point, because I am processing it, as I say, as part of the handover. And I'm going to ensure that we do that. Obviously, there has to be someone who actions the decisions that are taken by this committee. It is not something that we can all do all at once. So part of the processing of our division is that I take the responsibility in ensuring that they get implemented to a point where in what we expect to happen does happen. So I note that expression, Honourable Member. Arnold, you want to say something? I see you're standing on the podium.
Come again, Chairperson.
I see that you are already standing on the podium before I even recognize you.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning also to the Honourable Members and then the officials that is present. No, Chairperson, I think we must take a stand here. And Commissioner Makawusi, who is also an honorable member here and part of the committee, is right. We can't continue like this. And we must not continue with this meeting without the political principles here. It's unacceptable. So I second the proposal that we must get the principals here, the deputy or the minister must come here with the department and account also. We can't continue like this, Chairperson. This is now your second meeting or third meeting, and they are not here.
Okay.
And we must keep them, Chairperson.
All right. No, I hear that you are seconding the motion. Members, there is a motion which is put forward by Honorable Mukause and is seconded by the Honorable Arnold. I want to understand if maybe there is a different view. I see the hand of the Honorable Modise. You are recognized.
Yes. Good morning, Honorable Members and the officials from the department. Honorable Chair, I agree. I know the point that the Honorable Members have raised. But today, because of, you said, it's three lines in the National Assembly, whereby time, let's continue with the meeting in their absence. And we know very well from time to time our deputy minister, when he is not committed, he is attending our committee. He's taking our committee very seriously. I know that all the issues that members have raised, they are true. But please, I plead with honorable members to continue with the meeting of today.
Thank you, Honorable Modisa. There is a counter proposal that let us not put a dead stop to this meeting and allow it to happen, and then maybe the issue that is being raised, that a follow-up meeting, we will not sit without the political principals of the department being here.
Sorry.
Let me recognize the Honorable Nana.
Engos Chanis, colleagues, I'm one of those people that are actually very much unhappy about the persistent absence of Minister Godan. Before the budget vote debates, I do not know when last did I see him. We are not friends. I don't intend to be friends with him, of course, but I'm just saying, I don't know when last did I see him in front of the committee appearing before the committee. But, and colleagues will recall, you know, Glenin, we teach people how to treat us. And when they treat us in the manner in which we taught them, we then start to complain. We have been talking about this from 2019. And I am really tempted to second what Honorable Makau says just proposed. But what weighs heavily on me is the fact that in our meeting of last week, we had asked you to look into this matter. And you have set a process in motion in addressing this matter. So I would really plead with Honorable Arnold and Honorable Makausa to allow you space to conclude the process. Hopefully, it is not going to be too long before we see fruits, or you come and report to the committee as to the outcomes of your engagement with the minister. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Nana. So, as it were, Honorable Members, we have the two motions, and the second motion goes back to the initial decision that we had taken, that we sort of start a process of engaging and ensuring that we take corrective measures and we ensure that going forward, after we have process that resolution, that this matter is corrected, and ensure that going forward the minister or the deputy will always appear when we have this meeting, especially where we have said we expect them to come and make representation here. So I would plead with the members that it is not going to be too long, and I'm addressing this matter quite objectively because I represent the committee in doing this, and I represent the interests of the members. So I am myself as the chairperson in agreement, and I respect the resolution because I'm part of its making, and therefore we will take it to its logical conclusion. I don't want us to take much time to discuss this, and I have wish that perhaps we would have discussed it in camera, but it's fine. There's nothing that we're hiding about what we are talking about. We will take it forward, and I am sure that in the next meeting, I will be giving you a progress report. I will not wait until the matter is concluded, but I will give you progress report. So that should be telling that already the process is in motion, and therefore I will be in a position to give you progress report. Whether it's positive or negative, I will come back to you, member, and tell you exactly what is obtained. Can we agree? Yes, Honorable Mkausa.
Chairperson, in as much as you have agreed in the previous meeting where I was not present, mm-hmm. that you are going to seek audience from the ministry, but I want to rightfully point out, Chairperson, that this is not starting now. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you and Honorable Modise, if you allow these ministries that you are chairing to undermine us, they are not going to undermine the EFF, they are going to undermine the ANC, which is chairing this committee. Now, I want them to know and understand that we are not the type of people who take kindly when people undermine us. We hold people accountable, irrespective of their position within the government of South Africa this term. We want to hold the minister accountable, and the minister cannot be immune to attending this select committee and prioritizing a three-line whip of the National Assembly. If they misses a three-line whip within the National Assembly and attending a committee, doesn't mean that they are absent. So none of you's got a right to come here and make excuses for ANC employees for not attending meetings. The officials within the ministry are not political heads. When we speak as members of parliament, we want answers from political heads. They can add where they add as senior officials, but we want political heads. So when you let them to undermine you, don't involve the EFF. They will undermine you in this committee. They will continue to undermine Honorable Modise in a committee like they are doing. It's because when we speak, you are protecting them. They take that as senior officials, the principals, to say, we are fine in those committees, while they know that other political parties have an objection to what they are doing. So don't involve us, Chairperson. Go and get your political deploy to come and account to the select committee.
Honorable Mukausa, no, we hear what you are saying, but I don't think your conclusion is correct that we are bodyguards to ministers here. We have a responsibility to ensure that the ministers account here. We represent another arm of the state which is responsible for our oversight, which include exactly the point you are making of ensuring that the executives are made to account. And that's what we represent. I don't think we must cast aspersions. We have a resolution collectively, and we agreed that there should be a process in place to ensure that what we expect to happen, it actually does happen in line with the principles of accountability. So we'll do that, and I would not want to delve into the politics now that you want us to really take that particular direction. Let's agree, as I have indicated, that we will ensure that we put these matters forward to the minister, and I will update you in the next meeting as to how far have we gone. Let's agree in that spirit, honorable members, and allow, therefore, for the Transnet group to present to us what we expect to see. We did receive the presentation yesterday. I think it was the updated or the latest presentation, which is going to serve here. I would like now to invite the leader of delegation from Transnet Group, representing, of course, the DPE, and if there are any other officials that are coming directly from the DPE, they must help us by introducing themselves. The leader of delegation must help us by introducing everyone was here, Transnet Group, as well as the subsidiary, which is the Transnet Port Authority. You are welcome, and you can take the floor.
Morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm Push Davis, CEO of Transnet. I will do a brief introduction, and then this is not the first night, guys. Can you go to the beginning of the presentation, please? And we will have Chair, the CEO of TNPA, Bebe Silinga, who will talk through the Port Master Plan. And then our Chief of Strategy, Dr. Andrew Shaw, will make a short presentation. Chair, I'm not sure if the DPE wants to say something. Otherwise, we can start with the presentation. I will just pause briefly. Okay. Can you go to the next slide, please? So it's a Chair, for us, this is actually really an exciting development, both the expansion of Durban, which is way dull overdue, as well as the investments to bring Mocha to full capacity utilization, which has actually really taken us a long time. You know, when you consider the fact that the design of the Port of Durban and its capacity was fundamentally set in 1963, way before, I mean, if you think of industrial activity in South Africa, probably the most active sectors at the time were autos manufacturing. In fact, the terminal that you see on the left-hand side pretty much what we still have till today. I just, you know, one of the things that when you look at the positioning of Port of Durban, which is the hub port and probably the second largest and most busy port on the continent, to have remained exactly at this stage is, I think, quite unfortunate. Recently, we've been spending a little bit more time just benchmarking and looking at developments with other ports on the continent. Our total capacity in Durban today is 3.1 million TEUs. If you look at the port of Abidjan, GDP is $50 billion. Our GDP is $422 billion, and I think that's the 2020's figures. Their total capacity at the Port of Abidjan has now been increased to 2.7 million TEUs. And if you look at our total capacity in Durban, it's 3.1 million TEUs. Just keep in mind the relative sizes of the two economies. The depth of the Port of Abidjan is now at 16 to 17 meters. The depth of Durban is anywhere between 11 and 12.2 meters. Also, furthermore, if you look at the capacity and the size of vessels that are now able to arrive fully laden in Abidjan, 14,000 TEUs, and in our case, we can only take 11,000 TEUs fully laden. So it's just, I suppose, Chair, by putting those comparative stats is to bring to the point that this development is way overdue, and we all have to find, just as South Africans, and even ourselves as Transnet, are working very hard to make sure that we ensure that this development happens as fast as we possibly can. Now, when we present, one of the things that you hear when we talk about the increasing of the capacity from the 3.1 million tons that we TEUs that we want to move from to 11.3, there are some who argue that we are expanding it too fast and there's no demand. We would argue that it is absolutely essential that we do the development as fast as we can, because when we look at the volumes that we potentially can move in South Africa, a discussion about rail, we'd be more than happy to have a presentation done by the next committee chair at some future date. We know that there's huge volumes that we would be able to move out of this port if we had investors. And then there's the opportunity of transshipment. And transshipment would enable us to get to much larger volumes, because the nice trend that's emerging is that ports are looking, shipping lines are looking for large ports, which are able to take large containers. and use those as hub ports that are moving out. Durban is a natural hub for the southern hemisphere, firstly, but also for the continent. Chair, I will hand over to Betty Selinga. Can you move on to the next slide, please? I will hand over to Betty Selinga at this point. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair.
Morning, Dr. Selinga.
Chair, I'm on.
How are you? I see you are still
right.
Trying to get ready.
Yeah, no, I'm all right, Chair. Thank you so much. Chair, just to continue on the presentation, the introductory remarks by the GCE, we've clustered the two ports because they are complementary insofar as the development that's actually going to be undertaken. Insofar as the Port of Devon is concerned, being, if you like, the hub, the container, I would say, the real deal in the South African port system, to the extent that it contributes significantly close to just about 40% of our revenue and basic economic activity. The Port of Richards Bay, being a hub in particular for the Tri-Bulk, and some of which would be relocated from the Port of Devon, and we'll see in the presentation. And lastly, we have at the moment a base, South African Navy base, in the Port of Devon, in the Salisbury Island, and the intention is to then relocate that to the Port of Richards Bay, which obviously would also help insofar as and locating that security capability at the entrance of the coastal part of our country, and maintain a satellite station at the port of Devon as the economic hub. If we can move to the next slide, please. Can we move to the next slide? Yes. And that particular slide, the chair, reflects Devon as it currently exists. And I'm not going to spend much time on it because we will be speaking on each particular element as we make the presentation. If we can move to the next slide. Now, Chair, in this particular slide, I want you to start by looking at A, which is in the middle, if you see where A is. And that is where Pier 1 and Pier 2 is actually located. And in particular, there's a process for Pier 2, which is an invitation for the private sector partner to actually partner the current terminal operator there, which is Transnet Port Terminal. And then if you look at B, which is not, you would see that that's where the SFN is, and I don't know if we can move the cursor from a presentation point of view, that's where the SFN yacht basin is actually a concern. And we then, at the entrance of the port, which is number one check, on the right-hand side, and that's where the cruise terminal, that facility has been completed. It has been built over a period of about 3 years, was at some stage affected by the COVID shutdown, but it is completed. And then we move to number two, Chair, which is the automotive terminal. This is one of the developments that is meant to be expanded, and it's going to require a lot of configuration of the existing footprint, including connecting with a portion of land that is currently outside the port as it actually stands. And if we then move Chair to the next thing, which would be in this particular instance, the container terminal. Can we move to number four, container terminal, which is where the 1.8 TEU. This is a Chair. We've gone out again on a PSP on that particular development with a view of increasing that particular capacity at point. And this is one of the first developments that we're actually undertaking. And if we move to the MPT, the multipurpose number 5, which is on the left-hand, bottom left-hand side. And that particular development would be the next program that would actually follow check. And you then move to number 6, which is where Pier 2 is actually located. Now, there are interconnectedness checks insofar as how these developments are actually going to take place. Because in some instances, there is relocation of some of these activities that needs to be relocated to another place to open up the space for the development to actually take place in that particular area. And then number 7, being also the SACD site, which would also be number 7, which is at the bottom, which is would also be used for a container storage. At the moment, there's a current tenant in there, and the timing of that relocation would obviously be at a time when that lease agreement has also run with repair. And number 8, which is at the bottom left, we have the main entrance to what I would call the liquid bulk heartland of the Port of Devon, as well as Pier 1 and Pier 2, which is through a road which is called the Bayhead Road. It is that road or access road that was in fact cut off during the around Easter Easter flood, and there's a need to actually upgrade that particular road, de-risk it by creating alternatives in the event that a particular carriageway is adversely affected, so that we maintain constant accessibility off the port or through the port under whatever circumstances that may actually arise. And the 9th one, chair, which is at the top, is the Maiden Wharf channel deepening. One of the points that the GTE alluded to is the size of the vessel that this port is capable of accommodating. Not only do we need to deepen it, both at berth, but also the approach channel, so that we are able to get the vessels of sufficient capacity. As we stand at the moment, in some instances, the vessels would come heavy laden to the port, and they must offload first at the Pier 1 and Pier 2 before they can actually go to Maiden Wharf because of the draft in that particular channel. So that's one of the common user infrastructure that, in fact, needs to be broadened as well as deepened so that we can take the bigger vessels. And if we go to number 10, which is the dry dock, the dry dock care is where we basically take care and repair and maintain the vessels that when they have come to the Port of Devon and they require some tender care. It's a critical function to the extent that it's a value-add service that the ports give, which enables the port to put a time that they will be in a port a productive time, so that when it actually leaves, it doesn't have to stop elsewhere where it would actually be receiving that particular tender care. And the last one, and I'm just going to be jumping to the Navy side, the source, which is number 12. So what we're hoping, which is on the entrance on the left-hand side, what we're hoping to do, chair, or intending to do, is to relocate around number 15, which is where the current naval base is actually located. If we can show where number 15 is, and relocate a portion, a small portion of that capability to number 12. At number 12, there is currently a dry bulk for manganese, amongst others, and that is going to be relocated to Richards Bay. That's where the interconnectivity in terms of enabling what our plan is in this particular port. If we can move to the next slide, please. And we come back, Chair, just to emphasize at the entrance of the port on the right-hand side, these two, this particular precinct, and it's adjacent to the port residential development. A is the cruise terminal that has just been constructed, and B is the point container terminal. And you can see the shaded the shaded orange. That's the existing footprint, and the broadened one with the simulated vessels, the bigger one, it would be the expansion that would enable us to take that particular capacity to 1.8. And C is where the automotive terminal is actually going to be located. Can we move to the next slide, please? Effectively, Chair, the development is aligned and is in pursuit of a container segment a strategy, and really the strategic intent from a country point of view, and of course, prioritizing the hub, the container hub in Devon, is to ensure that we improve the capability, infrastructure capability, so that we can improve operational efficiency and productivity at the port level. And to the extent that that should enhance and improve commercial performance, and engender a sense of maritime connectivity. And we're looking at what we would call a hub and spoke, where the big vessels would actually come into that particular area, and the smaller vessels would then pick up from Devon and would actually link up with the other ports in the country, as well as southern hemisphere as well. And we need to in particular make sure that the core infrastructure in this particular instance would be the capability of the berth, insofar as the length of the berth, as well as the depth of the approach channels, as well as alongside the berth, are in fact different to be able to cater for the bigger vessels that are now in motion. Next slide, please. The time frame, Chair, this slide is basically meant to indicate that all of these have been time framed. And you can see the cruise terminal that has already been completed. Of course, the critical function, first and foremost, which is stipulated in terms of the legislation, is the approval of the port master plan, which needs to be tabled in front of the both the Port Consultative Committee, which is a statutory body in terms of the Act, as well as the National Port Consultative Committee, which has the duty of recommending to the Minister for the Department of Transport. And those master plans would then be gazetted as the approved and the regulated basis upon which development is actually going to take place. And we are targeting that we should be finalizing that particular process by around mid-August for a quick consideration and subsequent approval. This also includes the redefining of boundaries insofar as in the port of Devon, incorporation of a particular area called Ambrose Park for the development of the truck staging area, which is part of increasing operational efficiency and decongesting the port, but also incorporating the area in which we're going to be including the car terminal, which is just outside the current port boundary. And of course, we've indicated that the request for information had already gone out. That is insofar as Pier 2 is concerned. We are also in the process of finalizing the regulatory approval for the relocation of the head office of the Port of Devon, because that's where the container terminal is in fact going to be developed. That also includes the relocation of the fruit terminal, so that that particular area is part of the automotive terminal that's actually going to be developed. And you will see that it's reflecting around between the second and the third quarter in this financial year. So the point, Chair, that we're actually making is that the activities, the main activities, are underpinned by a particular rationale, both in terms of construction activity, so that it's an optimized construction activity, in terms of the pressure that we're currently facing to respond to the market demand, but as well as the availability of equipment, because once you have established sites for these types of developments, which are in the order of tens of billions of rand, it is not prudent to establish sites to a small portion de-established, because it's going to cost you 300 lakh to actually establish site again. So that is what we would call congregation of certain activities to optimize the cost per activity, because the fixed cost would be carried by a much wider a base of a construction activity. And the projection, Chair, is that we would like to move this particular development relatively very fast. And the projected time frame is ideally we would want to do it within the next 8 to 10 year projection. And the capacity, the strategic intended capacity, is 11.4 million TEUs, which is a significant uplift from where we are currently sitting at, which is equivalent of a third of its current capacity. If we can move to the next slide, please. And we've already covered this particular one, Chair. And as part of the decongestion, part of the reimagining of the Port of Durban is to enhance its linkages with the rest of that particular basin, what we call the Ethekwini Basin, and in particular, Cato Ridge, insofar as that particular area also presenting opportunities. This is along the N3, where between Durban and Pietermaritzburg, which is right up at the top of the ridge, which acts at the moment as a truck staging area and containers as well that are actually being in some instances set in there. It's already proving itself to be a logistic hub insofar as a number of companies that are in the just-in-time, just-in-case production of packaging of goods. So there's a lot of enhancement that particular type of facility would create insofar as decongesting the port of Durban. I've already spoken about Ambrose Park, Chair, and Ambrose Park is the portion of land which is just adjacent to the Bayhead Road, which we would use for the truck staging area, but also to create a parallel road which would be part of Bayhead, so that we're not stuck in one corridor if and when there's a problem with a particular corridor. And this is what would also necessitate the approval of new boundaries to incorporate Ambrose Park. Can we move to the next slide, please? And we've spoken, Chair, about the master plan. The ports, because they are strategic assets, and the TNPA itself is regulated in terms of the Act of 2005, and the funding is in terms of the tariff that gets approved by the port regulator of South Africa. The infrastructure within the ports is developed in terms of a regulated framework, which we have to ensure that it has got what we would call intermodal logistics, considering the contribution of rail, the contribution of road, and to the extent that all the ports are located within a particular city, and the extent to which the synergies in the development of the port and those synergies flow into the city and vice versa. And of course, because these are significant employment opportunities or economic activities, that they actually respond to the human capital development needs of the ecosystem in which they actually exist. And all these particular connectivities find expression in these port consultative committees, in which forum the various stakeholders, the port holder, port user, interested and affected parties have actually a voice. And TNPA is in fact obliged to take those particular concerns on board and be able to factor those in the planning of infrastructure. So if we could move to the next slide, please. And in that particular development, Chair, the strategic approach that has actually been adopted is to ensure that in the process, the private sector players are brought in a manner and pace that they are able to mitigate against those areas which the public sector might not necessarily have the best strength to be able to operate in those particular areas. And so we are in a big drive to actually activate private sector interest in taking these particular opportunities. And we're doing that by the provision of the basic economic infrastructure, or what we would consider to be common user infrastructure, so that we ensure at any time common user access to any party that in fact wants to use that particular infrastructure. And this particular picture, Chair, is the picture of Richards Bay. And we indicated that we would be relocating the dry bulk, which actually comes from the eastern side of the port entrance, to the extent that we're also going to be relocating the naval base. And the naval base, Chair, is going to be relocated to Naval Island. And I don't know if the Kesa could move to Naval Island, as well as the Pelican Island, those two islands. That's where we're going to be accommodating the naval base. And later on, the slides would depict some of the development. We're also going to be, to the extent that we're also going to be impacting on Island View, which is on the left-hand side in the port of Devon, and some of those particular elements would actually be relocating to this particular port, which would be just next to the coal terminal. And if we can go to the next slide, we should be showing. And for the port of Richards Bay, Chair, we also have got a particular project. We went out on an RFP about three months or so for a gas, for an LNG project, which would be in number 10. If you can just take the Kesa in number 10, which is in the center, just in the center of the, that's where the LNG station is going to be. It's just next to where the coal terminal is, in fact, located. And in that particular cluster, Chair, you see, if we just go just a little bit south, 9B, which is where the liquid bulk precinct in particular is going to be. So this is the area, Chair, in which from a gas complex point of view, we would be looking at concentrating in that area. And we would recall that both the port of Richards Bay, as well as the port of Mocha and the port of Saldanha, are the three projects or the three ports that are earmarked for floating solutions, temporal solutions, which would be gas-fired powered generation. And Richards Bay is earmarked as a major hub with the already existing demand from industry for the gas as a product and the already existing connectivity in terms of the pipes that are connecting Richards Bay to the rest of the economy. If we can move to the next slide. And again, Chair, this is the construction activity for the port of Richards Bay. And in any development, Chair, as you would know, if you are going to be doing a residential area, we don't just move in and do houses. We first must do the roads that are leading to that residential area so that you can actually access that particular site. And you make absolutely sure that the bulk services, so it will just be both connectivity in terms of a utility. So the roads would need to be enhanced. The rail capacity would need to be increased as well. To complement the strategy of moving from road to rail. If we currently think about the port of Devon at the moment, having the capacity that we talk about, which is a third of 11.4 million. If you have 11.4 million TEU and you are still dependent on the current trajectory of road utilization in the orders of magnitude that are currently in place, you basically will collapse the city. So the concept of moving cargo from road to rail is a strategic necessity. And to the extent that it would pose what I would consider to be an existential crisis for the port from an effectiveness and efficiency point of view, because you would effectively have a complete gridlock. The same is already confronting us in Richards Bay. If you go to the port of Richards Bay, you will see the trucks that pack on the road as they are actually coming to drop the bulk material over there. And it's quite evident that the port itself and the development of the city and the planning, that integrated planning that ought to have taken place, did not happen to the extent that it actually could have. And this is an opportunity for us to actually go into an integrated port, an integrated city development with the complete intermodal logistics planning that is able to project the demand and be able to accommodate how those would actually be taken care of. I think the significant issue for me around Richards Bay would be the three areas that we will consolidate around the bulk area, because we're going to be locating bulk on Devon to accommodate the Navy and move that bulk to the port of Richards Bay. We're going to be consolidating around the South African Naval Base, including the support residential area, which is projected would require up to 1,000 residential households to accommodate the naval base support over there. We're also consolidating around the liquid bulk infrastructure, including a gas-fired power station in there. And the berths would then need, in around the South Dune, would need to be adjusted and fitted for that particular purpose. And the last one that is also being planned is to actually get a private sector interest for the development and the operation of a dry dock, to the extent that that port as well would have the requisite capacity to sustain a dry dock. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. So to just conclude, Chair, we have had to make sure that we are not just obsessed with our own image, and we seek what we call independent expert validation of the work that has actually been undertaken. And that work has been done by a range of professional companies in partnership with the World Bank. And that work is projected to see its end at the end of July. We get periodic reports and we do reality checks on some of the work that we've already done. And we have had to improve and iterate some of the ideas that we actually had on the basis of that particular feedback. So it's been a very constructive and a very useful engagement, Chair, that has enabled us, if you like, to optimize on the output and also reduce on the projected cost side, based on the ideas that have come out of those particular exercises. We also have to go through a detailed consultation process. Earlier on, there was a thought that around the Island View corridor, there might be a need to dig out the Island View. It's now become apparent that we can, in fact, minimize digging of the Island View, and that's also a product of the extensive consultations that have actually taken place. So we would be going back again to the stakeholders, and ultimately that process would find ultimate conclusion in the National Port Consultative Committee, and after which it would then submit to the Minister of Transport. There are, at the moment, current concerns, Chair, around Maidenwa. Maidenwa, that's where the bulk of the agricultural products are actually coming through, and a variety of other products that come through, whether it's fertilizer or sugar or maize, they actually come through Maidenwa. And we've got a whole range of concerns. And that particular area, as you might be aware, does not enjoy, if you like, a protection or security separation from the rest of the city. While that might promote integration, but it's got its own serious limitations, to the extent that when you actually need to secure it, you don't know where to start and where to finish, because it's currently not configured for us to be able to secure it. And secondly, the state of the road, the coastal road just behind Maidenwa, not only is it full of trucks that are parked on the road at any point in time, sometimes up to 300 trucks, and occasionally when there's a disagreement between the trucks, either and the clients or the owners of the trucks, then we've got trucks that are basically used to lock down as a registration of their protest. So there's a major reconsideration that needs to take place around the logistics within the port, and Maginot being the point area that we're going to be doing that. Next slide, please. If we may then move, Chair, to the escape cluster. So from a focus point of view, we have subdivided the port system, and we've got eight ports. We've divided the commercial ports, eight ports, versus the nine ports, which is managed and operated by DBS. Of the ports, eight ports that we are looking after as the Transnet National Port Authority, we've clustered them into three areas. The eastern port, which is Richards Bay and the port of Devon, and then we've got the port of East London, the port in the two ports in Gabeha, as well as the port in the Western Cape, Mossel Bay, the port of Cape Town, and the port of Sagana. And we've got a variety of projects, Chair, in the port of in the port in Gabeha. And I'm just going to quickly run through the first port, the first project, which is a significant project, is that of a manganese a terminal, a storage terminal that is actually being developed in the port of Mocha. And the idea, Chair, is to increase the capability of this particular channel to 16 million tons. The idea ultimately would be to consolidate ports into specialized cargo so that we know if we're talking about fruit and the citrus type of product, Cape Town would be our main port that would be looking at. It doesn't mean that nothing would be going to other ports, but we would know that that's our best foot forward. And if we're talking about export of iron ore, Saldanha being our best foot forward. And insofar as manganese is concerned, the proposition would be both the port of Mocha and the port that is being looked at in the West Coast, which will currently use the term the port of Bukubai, as the two ports that would be dominating in the manganese field. So we have to do a storage facility, and the projection is that that particular port in the next, rather terminal in the next 5 years should be in operation. We currently have got a lot of work. It had gone out on an RFI. It's just about to go out on an RFP so that it can be adjudicated and a build contract would be awarded. It's significant in the order that we're talking about billions of rand, certainly above 7 or 8 billion rand. And the second project that we're actually looking at is the port of Mocha. It's the latest container terminal, which is completely underutilized. Currently, we're sitting with a capacity of about 2.1 million TEUs, currently utilized on an exceptionally good year, 800,000, 900,000 TEUs. So sitting at less than what I would call 40% capacity from a utilization point of view. This is one of those projects that is in the process of attracting a PSC interest and a party that would be able to bring volume so that we can generate the commercial return that this port is actually capable of. And Ford has taken a decision that their vehicles would in fact be exported through the Gabeha channel, which requires increasing of the rail capacity to be able to accommodate moving manganese from road to rail, which is increasing sitting on the road at the moment, but as well as accommodating the vehicles that would actually be coming up, which requires an additional investment from a rail point of view, Chair, in the order, give or take, 1.7, 1.8 billion rand. And this particular project necessitates that we concentrate the existing ports in Gabeha, in particular what is legislated as the port of Port Elizabeth, focus it on being an automotive hub, but as well as being a hospitality port. And that requires that we relocate the liquid bulk tanks that are currently existing there, as well as the manganese terminal. So there's a major reconfiguration of that particular port that would enable a waterfront type of development, concentration of an auto terminal as well, and relocate the manganese that's going through that particular channel, relocate it to the port of Mocha. If we can move on to the thing. And insofar as East London is concerned, we've got a few projects that we have to drive, Chair, and one of those particular projects is to focus on the silos that are there. Historically, the Port of East London was an agricultural port over and above being what I would call a ship a repair, the smaller vessels, ship repair, as well as an auto terminal servicing a Mercedes-Benz. So there's a great focus in ensuring that that particular port, we create a much deeper channel to enable bigger vessels to actually come in, ensure that we reinvest in the capability to handle the agricultural product and get those silos back commissioned for trading in maize. It's already a port that is in fact exporting animals as well. So there is an economic activity. But over and above that, it's also got the capability to be able to export any of the bulk materials that might be surplus in other ports. The railway line that links East London has got a lot of slots that are currently underutilized and therefore would be an efficient throughput channel for any surplus material that otherwise would have been exported through another port. Next one. And we've already spoken about this particular slide, and you see the slightly yellow, close to there. That's where the manganese storage facility is, Chair. And we would obviously have to connect with the port itself, the port of Muka, using a conveyor belt. And the next slide, hopefully, Chair, would actually be indicating the type of project that can we move to the next slide. That's in the port of Muka. And one of the projects in the port of Muka, Chair, that are very attractive would be the gas infrastructure that needs to be put in place. You'd recall that earlier on I mentioned that it's one of the three ports in which the gas project, both the temporal solution of a floating storage regasification unit that would need to be located in there, and then obviously ultimately moved to being plugged to the substations that would be in the area. On your left-hand side is the container terminal that I was actually talking about and the theoretical capacity that we actually talked about, which is 2 million, and you can see the extent to which it is currently underutilized, hence that PSP that we were speaking about, Chen. And the middle in the central precinct, that would be the C-Series, that's where manganese is exported, those simulated two vessels over there. And then on the other side of that shinga would in fact be located, on the left-hand side, in the same, on the finger, the finger, the middle. In the middle, that one. But the right-hand side in there, that's where the liquid products would actually be located, as well as on the eastern side, including the gas projects. Next slide. Next slide, please. And this would be just indicating, Chair, where the particular projects are actually located. If you start on the right-hand side, Chair, that would be, you see that there's a vessel which says it's got an LNG terminal. So that would be the stationary vessel for the temporal solution, which would be a floating storage solution. And a mobile solution would come, a tanker would actually come, and that tanker would actually be bringing in the product. It would go into that particular standing vessel, it would be converted, and it would be taken by a particular pipeline, and it would be transferred to the next vessel, which has got an arrow, which says a liquid bulk there. And initially that floating product would be a power ship, and it would generate a power, and then it would have cables that are running to a substation, which are located in the particular area. And you see the tanks on the right-hand side, Chair, and those are tanks that one for the storage of the liquid, so that it's a balancing tank. You're not dependent on the storage, which will be in the vessel, because the demand and supply might be fluctuating. So you need the balancing tank so that you are able to cope with a peak period, but also store when you have got supply and the demand is low. And as you move towards your left-hand side, you'll see where the tank farm is. That's where the connectivity between these two ports in the Durban are creating, because we will be relocating the liquid bulk tanks that have been in the port for Fortress Abyad for the past 67 years, and those will be relocated to that a particular precinct. And we move towards the left-hand side where you see an arrow which indicates where the conveyor belt is. And that conveyor belt would be the one that would be taking the product from the manganese storage, which is behind there at the far back, and it would be taking it to the C series F, which is the finger jetty and inside the port precinct. Next slide, please. I'm not going to spend too much time here because I've already spoken to this particular slide. This is the port of Port Elizabeth as it is currently legislated in Gabeja. And you see on the right-hand side, extreme right-hand side, that's where the liquid bulk terminal. We have given an indication here of the time frame. So this project, we have started expediting the particular project and chasing that by 2025. It should be operational at the port of Moka. And then you also see where the bulk ore terminal, which is also going to be relocated to that storage area that we spoke about in the port of Moka as well, which would then enable a waterfront development in that particular portion. And you see the multi-purpose terminal, which is in the middle. And this also reflects the extent to which there's, in some instances, underutilization of capacity. And by repurposing these ports and focusing them on a particular product, we can then develop what we consider to be centers of excellence from an operational point of view in a particular product and be able to benchmark them with the comparable ports in the world. And the last one on the left-hand side is where we currently have the PE container terminal. And this is where we're going to be focusing on the automotive terminal chair to accommodate both VW as well as Ford. And hopefully there will be other products as well, like bike that is in town, and FAW as well, to focus on maximum utilization of this particular business. Next slide, please. We've covered this chair. The strategic intent in all of these particular investments are the same. So if you can move to the next slide. We've already spoken about this particular project, which is the Mohammadanese expansion project, and it gives you a sense of what would be happening. That includes putting the appropriate equipment so that you can load onto the vessels relatively very quickly so that we reduce the turnaround time. One of the key performance indicators from a point from a port point of view is what is called a ship turnaround time, which is the time that it actually takes from the time that the vessel crosses the breakwater coming inside to being tied at berth, being worked on by the appropriate terminal operator, the ropes being loosened, and the tugs being available to actually take that vessel out. And at the moment, we are lagging behind the international best practice by a significant mile. So part of that, to the extent that it's possible, is also putting the appropriate equipment and automating where we actually can, so that we can increase the operational efficiency and effectiveness throughout the port system. Next slide, please. And these would be the time frames, maybe on the right-hand side, here, just to indicate that the RFP for this particular project, we are supposed to be going out within the next 2 weeks on the RFP. The RFI had already been concluded, Chair, and we're projecting that construction start date would be around between March and around June in the next financial year, and that the operation would actually take place in 2027. What is would happen because of the machine-intensive nature of these types of operation, the commissioning is likely to take anything up to 9 months. So you would be looking at commissioning starting around September of 2026. So that by March 2027, the equipment is proven to be fit for purpose and is capable of delivering to the design standards that would have been proposed. Next slide, please. The Moka Rail Capacity Chair, we've already spoken about that, and you can see the time frames on the bottom right. Project teams have already been setup, the current work that is underway to package the project for financing opportunities, because the nature of the finance that is required is such that we wouldn't always be able to take all of these into the balance sheet. Construction projected to start around March 2023, and again being able to accommodate, and because it must align with the functionality of the manganese storage facility, and would recall, Chair, that the Ford export contract is actually chasing the financial year 24-25. So by then, we must be able to accommodate both the autos that will be on the rail capacity, but as well as the manganese that would need to be able to utilize the capacity of the storage facility, which would be a significant increase from the current loads of give or take around 9 million tons that are coming through the Pebeka channel. Next slide, please. We've spoken, Chair, already about the gas import facility, and I'm not going to spend much time. You can see the vessel on the right-hand side. And please, we apologize for the name. We should have removed them. It's a simulation of the solution where the tankers would actually come and the floating storage regasification unit would offload to a vessel. And you can see a small line below that arrow. That is the pipeline that actually goes to the power ship. It goes alongside the breakwater, and it actually turns back to the power ship. You then generate power from power ship as a temporal solution, and then there would be lines that are going to the substations that are located in adjacent. That would be for the temporal solution. And of course, once you have done the full solution, you would have to have a permanent station, gas terminal, which would then have the balancing tanks outside, and then, of course, links then to the substation and ultimately to the grid. Next slide, please. Again, the time frame for this particular project in Richards Bay, Chair, you recall that we mentioned that it would actually gone out, and that particular bid was closed in April. We are still on stream to be going out on the RFP in July. This particular year, we're running a little bit ahead of what we thought might be a late start. And the target being by 2023-2024, that particular terminal should actually be open. In the precinct of Guha, we've got a joint development agreement, between the National Port Authority of Transnet, Central Energy Fund, which is developing a particular project for the gas-fired power station, which was part of the IPP project that was approved by national government. Next slide, please. Thank you very much, Chair. That's the end of my presentation.
Good morning, Chairperson and honourable members. My name is Andrew Shaw. I'm responsible for strategy and planning at Transnet Group level. I want to just share with you just two slides, which is the planning and segment positioning, particularly in respect of rail and fulfilling the requirements of economic growth through rail as a logistics solution. So let me spend a little bit of time talking to our current strategy and then also focus on our intent to try and encourage government to expend directly in rail and assist us in providing some strategic rail infrastructure going forward. We have nine segments, four of which are in the mining area. These are commercially viable businesses. The impact on GDP is around 5.4%, around 147,000 jobs. Obviously, there is, in most instances, not beneficiation. Most of this product is exported. Our investment approach at this point in time is to increase from just over 100 million tons by another 50 to 60 million tons in mining explicitly. We see the opportunity to thus grow TFR's revenue quite considerably, but we would have to do that in partnership with with the private sector, probably with the mining companies, to expand that capacity, largely because our balance sheet is just not able to bear the significant costs. So we have project plans in place in chrome and ferrochrome, in manganese, as well as in iron ore. In the case of coal, we do see some growth, but that growth is really dependent on our existing network. The real opportunity for us is in the middle two areas, which is containers and automotive and agriculture. The focus here is to drive up market share to support manufactured growth. And you can see that the real impact is approximately 18.9% on GDP, so considerably more than in the mining sector in the case of containers and automotive. And if you then add agriculture, which has about another 12.5% GDP in terms of its contribution to national GDP and the considerable logistics requirement, you'll see that we have, in those two segments, a huge impact on our ability to be competitive, grow jobs, and assist growth in those two segments. Our investment approach in both areas is to work in respect of partnerships on the rail system and capture rail market share where we can, but to also in alignment with the NDOT's policy pronouncements recently, to allow private sector operators on the slots that we don't use in three key corridors, Gauteng to Kubasa, Gauteng to East London, and principally Gauteng to Durban, where the greatest opportunities lie. In respect of agriculture, the challenge there is that in many instances, agriculture is quite widely dispersed in the rural provinces, and there's branch lines that are not effectively used. So we wish to drive the branch line concessioning process still harder in order to make rail more competitive and also to allow for private operators on slots that we don't use. I won't talk to fuel and gas. I think actually Pepe has spent quite a lot of time quite neatly placing the challenge of repositioning from fuel to a gas-based energy economy in respect of the principal investments in the ports. So let me go to the final slide, which really just summarizes some of our core requirements. Because of our financial positioning and our need to reposition TFR sustainably is that we see a requirement to tier the network. So we would have an A-grade network, which focuses on bulk freight, a B-grade network, which is for mixed freight and serves most of the cities, and then a C-grade network, which is largely the lower order part of the network and the concessioning of branch lines. We would also, again, in alignment with the with National Department of Transport policy, introduced new train operators with a focus to capture market share, particularly in agriculture and manufacturing. And we will drive a series of partnerships to expand capacity in key segments and grow volume. The partnership arrangements that we principally would like to enter in are with industry partners, with financial institutions that can help us to invest, and in some instances with logistics operators who would be able to bring us a share of the traffic that they currently move by road. What is key, though, to note is the last point, which is allowed for with respect to the new government policy around rail, but is to seek additional grant funding from government for rail infrastructure expansion and modernization. And we benchmark ourselves to the quite considerable government funding for road infrastructure, which competes directly against us for, particularly for mixed traffic. And when we benchmark this against other countries, what we see is most other countries have invested in rail infrastructure, maybe not necessarily in rail operations directly, but certainly in rail infrastructure. Let me leave it there, Chair, and hand back to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Chair. We are trying this would be done at this point. I know the DG, the Action DG is on the call, so she can close. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Portia and your team for this presentation. I am now going to put it to the members to engage with it by way of raising questions and clarity-seeking questions as well as the comments on the presentation. Thank you for that elaborate presentation. Members, can you now kindly indicate by way of raising hands, and then we take it from there. I see the hand of Mama Lindwe Bibi. I see the hand of the Honorable Nana. I see the hand of the Honorable Arnold. I see the hand of the Honorable Winnie Wenya and the hand of the Honorable Modise. And I think there's one more hand of Honorable Malehu. In that order, Honorable Members, we start with you, Honorable Bibi.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson Baba, for the opportunity. Greetings to you and also to the officials and also to my colleagues. Thank you, Chairperson, and also thank you from the department for the presentations of which we do welcome them. Chairperson, I've got two questions, and the first one will be looking at the global economic outlook, especially the impact of the COVID-19 on commodities. Now, do you think it worthwhile to invest in port infrastructure right now with no immediate returns on investments? And the second question, Chairperson, will be, what is your gearing ratio so that as members of this committee we can have an idea of how much you can still borrow from the market and how strong is your balance sheet? Those are the two questions, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm done, Chair. I'm done, Chairperson.
Honorable Anon.
Yes, Chairperson General.
You are rushing somewhere. If Honorable Anon is happy with that, please go ahead because he is not responding anyway. Go ahead, Honorable Anon.
You can go ahead, Honorable Member.
Age before beauty, Honorable Arnold. thanks very much, Chairman. And really, I would want to. It's something that I don't do quite often. To welcome a report, or to welcome a presentation. But give credit where it's due when it is so concise, clear to the point. It really talks to the leadership in that organization. Some members will know we've been around listening to quite a few presentations. But you hardly get a presentation which is full of sense. And thank you very much, Mrs. Portia and your team at Transnet. I probably have two questions, but before that, I would want to make a few observations. And the first observation relates to the announcement you've made with regards to the port of East London. Uh, I am pleased that despite not so much work planned for the immediate future, at least Port of East London is well within your radar. You've got plans for that port, which I quite frankly think it has got enormous potential, and it can provide much needed economic activity in support of Mercedes-Benz to make that port a lot more busier and active. So I truly accept that. I mean I welcome that. The second comment that I would want to make, Chairman, is with regards to Port St. John's. 2 years ago, if it wasn't last year, I raised a question about Port St. John's, which again I think have got enormous potential, and it can actually bring hope to a rather hopeless situation in Port St. John's. That is my constituency. The situation is not so good. Something has got to be done. So in this regard, I would really want to implore Transnet to really consider doing something in Port St. John's, which is not too far from Devon, which is not too far from London. I may not be exact as to the distance in terms of nautical miles, but with the naked eye, it doesn't seem too far, and I'm sure this is all the careful minds in Transnet, something can be done with Port St. John's. You will recall commitments were made that as a constituency leader in that area, I am constantly asked by communities whether they have been forgotten or what's the progress with regards to the promise to have a port that was to be built. So I would really like to get a comment from your side. Now, coming to my questions, Chairman. It's been reported in the media that the recent floods in KZN and parts of the Eastern Cape have actually caused mayhem at the Port of Devon. Now I want to check with Transnet as to the extent of the chaos that has been caused. Allegations were made that these days the port is not functioning optimally. I would really want to check to what extent has the floods negatively impacted the infrastructure of the port. To what extent has the floods negatively impacted the expansion plan? And lastly, to what extent has this negatively impacted business confidence in the port of Devon? And the last question, Chairman, a while ago, there were environmental groupings that were actually opposed to the expansion plans
fighting the negative impact that the expansion will have in the environment. Part of Devon, there is some species, I just look at species, there is some species that form permanent residents in the Port of Devon, and the expansion really threatened the existence of that species. To what extent has Transnet engaging with these things and have you guys found one another so far as protecting the species in the Port of Devon?
Thank you, Honorable Nana. I would like now to invite Honorable Arnold.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the presentation from Transnet. Yes, Chairperson, the country's ports and terminals are key engines for economic growth. And as a committee, we all agree that Transnet must get their house in order and they must work hard to ensure that the development happened very fast because they are responsible for safe, effective and economically efficient function of our national port system. There is a need, Chairperson, for massive structural changes because it reflects negative on the country that we have four of the worst ports in the world in terms of operational efficiency. My first question, Chairperson, is can we get comment from and details from Transnet in terms of the special purpose vehicle and how this will improve and resolve operational challenges? The second question, Chairperson, is in terms of the separation roles between Transnet National Port Authority, which is responsible for infrastructure ownership, and then Transnet Ports Terminals, which is responsible for the terminal operations. Do we have now clear roles in terms of these two entities, because that was also one of the challenges, and I think if there is now clear roles, can we get more details in terms of that now? Honorable Nana has covered me on the question in terms of the Durban terminals that was disrupted due to the bad weather conditions, so I won't go into that one. Yes, Chairperson, I think that is all for now. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Arnold. I now invite the Honorable Ngwenya. Mama.
Thanks, Baba. Good morning, Honorable Members. And Chair, let me take this opportunity and welcome the presentation from the Transnet. Having listened to the presentation, I have the following questions, Chairperson. I wanted to check whether Transnet has managed to develop rail capacity to accommodate the shift of volume from road to rail to decongest the road transport network to Port of Gira. If yes, can we get the details answer? And if no, why not? I want to check again what is the update regarding the petition to plan to improve export capacity of fully built automotive units such as additionally parking facilities and both the Port of East London and at the Port of Port Elizabeth.
But,
the third question, Chair. I wanted to check that who are the stakeholders of you and are intend to engage through the year of 2022 in KZN Port. Can you mention those stakeholders, please? And I want what is the current update with regard to the board of Transnet National Port Authority? Has the board been appointed? And if yes, who is the chairperson and the board member? If not, when will the board be appointed? On Front Rail Chair, I wanted to check that the maintenance of the rail rank is a competence of Transnet. What is the current state of the rail track that are used good trains and passenger trains? Last but not least, Honorable Chairperson, I wanted to check with the Transnet the effort they are making to respond to priority number 7 of government with respect to achieve. Oh my God. Sorry, Chair. Chair, I wanted to check with the Transnet the effort they have making to respond to priority number 7 of government, which respect to achieve a better African and the world.
Wow.
I have learned that Africa countries are growing sustainably in terms of their competitiveness. I like the ports of the motorists, Tanzania and Mombasa. The West African countries like Nigeria and Ghana are growing and investing and performing better than South Africa. Than South Africa ports. The question, Chair, is why are our ports still performing less than the countries I have mentioned? Chairperson, I asked this question in terms of my last question, I think it will be proper, Chair, for this committee also to go to these countries that have done better, seeing that we can learn from them how have they conquered the challenge that we are facing in South Africa. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Ngwenya. I now wish to invite the Honorable Modise. Honorable Modise, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and let me greet the honorable members and the officials from Transnet and from the department. Honorable Chair, I have only 2 questions. I just want to check with Transnet. What is the run around time at a Durban port? And how does it measure up against the international benchmark? My second question needs to be, for so many occasions, the president has indicated that state-owned company will need to work in public partnership with for infrastructure programs. I just want to find out if anywhere in a capacity or expansion project, there are private sector that are the role players who have shown a willingness to partner with you. Those are my two questions, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Modise. We also have the hand of the Honorable Malehu, but I see that the Honorable one is no longer in the platform. So maybe when the Honorable one comes back, we'll give the Honorable an opportunity. Yeah. Well, I think most of the questions have been put forward by the Honorable members, but my interest would just to add one more thing, to get a sense of transformation as it manifests in the sector, particularly as it relates to the counterparts. For a long period of time, there's been a suggestion that this sector is dominated by particular companies. I just want to get a sense of how the majority of the country are beginning to have a meaningful role in the space because of the historical issues. So we want to understand if we are making progress insofar as transforming and ensuring that a great number of our people from historical disadvantaged communities are playing part there. You will find that there are black-owned companies that are in the mining sector, and they are complaining about not having access to terminals, things like that. So can you please just juxtapose these developments of the expansion to that issue of access to terminals by these companies so that they are able to access markets? Because without access to the terminal, there's no access to the market, as it were. So I would like to get from the CEO of Transnet as well as the Ports Authority as to, are we really making a turnaround insofar as ensuring that our people are beginning to find an expression by way of a meaningful participation in that space? You can take it further because you are in the cold face of what is happening right there, so that you give us a total picture of what is obtaining. Those will be our questions. I now, Sposhiya Debi, give you an opportunity to deal with these questions and the comments together with your team. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, for the questions. I'll ask, we've got quite the Transnet Expo on the call, so different people will answer, but I've also just reached out to the CFO. She will answer the question around gearing. But let me foreground before she comes in the question that the Honourable Bibi asked. There is if you read any forecast of GDP for the next year or two, it doesn't help that we're coming out of COVID. You then have China having its lockdowns in Shanghai, which have had, and not only Shanghai, but which have had a serious impact on manufacturing. And then, and as you know, that China is generally the factory of the world. And it being the factory of the world is beyond the fact that we all get a lot of finished goods from China. It's the fact that they supply a lot of intermediate goods that go towards finished goods made in other countries. So it really has an effect of dampening production around the world. And then, thirdly, the Ukraine war in Ukraine and Russia also is having a serious impact on just outlook and general negativity. Having said all of that, all of these terrible situations create an amazing opportunity for South Africa, though. And one, suddenly everybody understands that wheat and the supply of sunflower seeds and all of those things is really concentrated in the world, right? So the issue of finding alternative locations for the planting of sunflowers and the rest of like in wheat, and also for the supply of these commodities. If you consider last year, you may have been watching, there was such a shortage of chips that the auto sector was directly impacted, that the vehicles were just not moving. Has meant that the supply chains are moving increasingly towards just in case. And places that have installed manufacturing bases are the most likely to win in that manufacturing war. Why we in South Africa have to win in that manufacturing war is because of the multipliers that manufacturing has, much deeper than virtually any sector, mining on the one hand and even agriculture, because manufacturing pulls so many products and into both of these supply chains quite significantly. One, number two, it actually is job intensive, the manufacturing sector. So there's that issue. What we know for a fact is that if we do not have efficient logistics, rightfully road, rail, and port, we will not be able to attract enough manufacturing. Now, the fortuitous position that we're in, and I suppose the presentation that we have, that we made today, was around ports. And a lot of the work that we're doing in all of the cities in which we operate where there's a port is talking quite seriously with the province and the municipal government around how we might be able to work jointly, leveraging also our packages of property that we have, so that actually we also unlock not just the port in terms of investment, but also back of port in terms of creating spaces for manufacturing opportunities. Because here's the thing. Most export-orientated economies do not have to deal with the 700-kilometer distance that we have to deal with in South Africa, where goods are coming from Gauteng and going to export routes. So it's actually quite crucial that not only as we invest in the ports, we invest in the ports, but we also find close to the ports manufacturing zones so that we can be able to genuinely take advantage of the opportunity that presents itself. So, Honourable Member, our view is that there is no time better and more urgent than the present to ensure that we have an efficient logistics system. Now, sadly, we can't have the cheapest logistics system because at the end of the day, we have to fund this directly off our balance sheet, and we borrow much of the money that we require. We've been talking a lot more closely with the DPE in terms of looking at how everybody else in the world funds basic infrastructure. Our view, and that's why this new white paper on rail is a paper that we really support, is that it is about time that government was an active player funding the infrastructure. The operations, we agree, that can be funded by ourselves directly, but there's a lot more support that we require from the fiscal to fund the maintenance of the track and expansion of capacity on the track. Nonkululeko, can I just ask you to answer the question of gearing and balance sheet, and then we'll move down each question, please.
Thank you, Portia, and good day to the honourable members. Good day to the honourable chair as well. Chair, how we look at the gearing of the balance sheet of Transnet is that we've got a long-term view that takes into account the financial plans in terms of what we're expecting to come in as financial income from our operations, but with the understanding that, as the GCE says, we do have to raise money from the capital markets and utilize that to continue with the so much needed projects that we have to run with. The second point to raise as well is that, as the chief executive of TNPA indicated, these are long-term projects that would take 10 years before we can basically see revenue coming from them. So the approach we have taken in gearing is that we've got a five-year corporate plan that has been supported by our board that says ideally the gearing of Transnet should range in the levels of 40 to 45%. And we look at this in the long term. At any given time, we may be going over that, but we are working towards this long term. So if we look at a project like this Port of Durban expansion, how we are looking at it is to say, how do we utilize third-party money to continue with the construction to ensure that we can support the so much needed economic growth? And this is where the concept concept of special purpose vehicles as well as partnerships comes in, where we can continue with the work, ring fence the money that is utilized into this special purpose vehicle until the project is completed and basically brings revenue to the business. But it's something we have to manage and ensure that in the overall picture, the project continues, but the balance sheet of Transnet is not overburdened. And therefore, we are engaging basically as we are busy with the project with various potential investors and lenders to see how we structure this project and make sure it's fully funded without overburdening the balance sheet of Transnet. But in the long range, we are looking at ensuring that the balance sheet of Transnet continues to be leveraged or use other people's money, but in the range of 40% to 45%. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chair, so the long and the short of it, what is approved by Treasury is 50%, right? So we are quite within, we still have room to borrow, but as I don't really like to say, is that we can't recklessly borrow. We need to be able to see the revenue that we take those loans. And Pepe, do you want to come in on the questions that the Honourable now has raised now?
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much, HSC. Chair, if I might then start with the question regarding, in fact, for the East London, it was really a comment, Chair. Yes, indeed, we welcome them. There is indeed a specific focus in each particular court, and the idea is to take each court to its maximum capability. And what we don't want to do is to have a self-fulfilling prophecy of a vicious cycle by not investing in a particular port, and on the basis of underinvestment, it then underperforms, which in turn then confirms our, if you like, what might be a biased position that in fact that port is unlikely to perform. So what, and we're not talking about just creating infrastructure for the sake of it. It is targeted. There's some detailed work that, in fact, needs to be done. And indeed, the Port of East London is very vital. Just beyond it anchoring Mercedes-Benz, because there's an industrial activity in that particular city. And clearly, based on just the sheer development of the market, the sizes of the vessels that are coming, by not upgrading that particular port to enable it to handle the current vessels, we're making the cost of doing business in that region a lot more expensive. Of course, it must be scaled so that we don't overinvest. So there is indeed, we concur, there is indeed an enormous opportunity. And besides, to the extent that there's an underutilized rail line that links to East London, it does make sense that we sweat all existing assets. And it would make sense that we put some more volumes through that particular line. Chair, insofar as Port St. John's is concerned, we would have to go back, Chair. I am honestly unsighted as to the issues in respect of Port St. John's, but we would happily go back and get a lot more detail through the Office of the GCE, and we would then engage with that question quite substantively as to exactly what was required of that particular precinct and what is actually possible in that particular area. If I might move to the next question, the floods in the Port of Devon. Well, the floods generally have got a multifaceted dimension. They cut across a range of Transnet divisions and with Transnet freight rates, I would suggest having suffered the most significant damages across the line as it actually goes up and out of KZN, linking to the rest of the internet. Insofar as TNPA is concerned, yes, that development, or rather the impact, was insofar as infrastructure is concerned, I would say relative to the impact on TFR would be, I would classify it as moderate. Nevertheless, in terms of quantum, as significant, we had the first 24 hours to about 30 hours were completely non-operational because we could not evacuate the product, at least not through Bay Head. There was a little bit that was being evacuated through the blast, which goes through the an urban area, residential area, with schools and that type of thing. Of course, what was of assistance was the fact that that period straddled the Easter weekend, which afforded us some time to recover and at least create some temporal exit point. And yes, the cost of repair for TMPA is in the order of billions of rands. We had our workshop, and that's where the bulk of our mechanical and electrical equipment is concerned. And that was actually flooded. The pump station that are in fact linked to the dry dock, those were completely flooded, and the Bay Head was actually cut off. There was a lot of debris that was lying all over the place. Of course, the terminal operators, I wouldn't speak on their behalf, but there was also significant adverse impact. So the cost implications, I think, in the total scheme of things for everybody, including private operators, indeed, I would classify it as pretty significant, especially because it would be coming at the back of last year's, if you like, disturbances, social disturbances. But the specific figures, Chair, we could, to be accurate, I'm a bit hesitant of, if you like, mentioning numbers without being pretty accurate. And insofar as the expansion plans, whether that development or rather the floods, whether they adversely impacted on the port development, not to the contrary, Chair. There is a saying that says, you must never let a crisis go to waste. What it actually did was to, in fact, confirm and validate some of the pointers that our strategy colleagues had actually been pointing to us, in particular insofar as ensuring that the linkages between the port and the rest of the city, that we look at those in a much more critical light, and that we plan for the projected volumes, and that we create alternatives. Often creating alternatives in the midst of nothing happening is regarded as a wasteful expenditure until such time that you actually need the alternative, and the consequence of not having it by far exceeds the cost of having provided that alternative. So it has afforded us to expedite the development of the Bay Head precinct. We're expediting the development of the truck staging area. Insofar as the canals are concerned, we are revising our stormwater master plan. Ordinarily, from an engineering point of view, we would be planning, if you bold, you would do a 1 in 50 year flood, and if you're crazy, you would do 1 in 100. We're now having to look at 1 into 500 a year flood, meaning that things that would happen once in a 500 year, in these days, are actually happening twice in 2 years. And that gives you a sense of regularity, and therefore the need to scale up infrastructure differently. We're also needing to work hand in glove, and that is already happening between ourselves and the city, in particular the Etobeni city. There are particular roads that have already been handed over to TNPA for purposes of expedited development, and those that have not been handed over, there's joint planning that is actually taking place, including the restoration of the Bay Head itself was done hand in glove between the KZN government, the Etobeni Metro, as well as ourselves from the Transnet side. The next question is around the business confidence. I must say, Chair, there was quite a lot of positive feedback, at least insofar as the time that it actually took, number one, to restore the functionality of that particular road. Because a business appreciated that that was a natural hazard that nobody could prevent. So the question was not whether or not it had actually happened. It was not also whether or not the damage that had been suffered had actually been caused. Was the extent to which, once it had happened, what was the speed of the response, the scale of response, and the interim measures that were actually put in place whilst a permanent solution were actually being put in place. And on that front, we did receive very positive feedback about also the extent to which the stakeholders were taken on board from the community, that they were able to make the plan, knowing exactly what was actually happening. As soon as the crisis became apparent, a joint planning, what I would call a war room, council was established, which was coordinated and chaired by TNPA, in particular, the board manager of Durban, Ms. Dweba. And that enabled the stakeholders to make input. We also collaborated, Chair, with the private sector, because some of the repair work was, in fact, if you like, facilitated and expedited at the instance of the private sector. So it was a good opportunity to test a partnership that should be a model of how we should be going forward. And so far as environmentalists are concerned, Chair, yes, there have been, we've got detailed records of the stages that were recorded insofar as the EIAs that were conducted in the port of Durban. And also one of the critical features in those records of decision is recommendations as to how the adverse impacts could be ameliorated by way of alternative plan. And that is something that we're actually looking at. We're very intense, Chair, on stakeholder consultation, and some of those stakeholders would find representations through the Port Consultative Committee as well as through the National Port Consultative Committee. Now that we are in what we call the last leg of conceptual development, we're going to be going back to all of those particular stakeholders and having intense consultation. So we do accept the imperative of environmental sustainability in the port development. And we do take those issues, and it's not a question of numbers. It's a question of the significance of impact of the issue that has actually been raised, even if it actually comes, if you like, from a small stakeholder. And, Chair, that those would be the questions, GCE, that were from Honorable Nana. I don't know if I should move to the other questions from Honorable Anon.
I just wanted to close off, Bebe, on so that it's very comprehensive. And as far as the impact of the floods in KZN, they really have been extensive, and especially was indicating the port, we were really, able to get the port to full operation in less than 3 days, actually. The real challenge was sorting out Bayhead Road, and I really must thank TNPA for stepping up and taking over the responsibility for delivering that that project. We're quite far along in finding an alternative, another routing, so that we increase the capacity out of the port. As you know by now, Bayhead is back to its full original capacity. But the view was always it should be much bigger than that. So the total for Transnet, exposure for Transnet out of the flight, which approaches 6 billion rand, and it's really a serious challenge that we need to find funding to make sure that we're able to deal with that extension. On the issue, we will follow up on Port Elizabeth, but I just wanted to also be pretty frank, Honourable Member, is that one of the challenges, if you look at Australia, Australia's got like over 20-something ports because just of the size of the country. And most of them are small ports which serve a basic small purpose. But its commercial ports has about 10 ports. And of that 10 commercial ports, 4 are the most important ports, and that's ports, and that's where they put in most of the money. Because it's expensive to invest in ports and to have a fully operational port. So I do think that one of the things that we've been trying to do is looking at the commercial ports that we have, is to use the segment strategy to ensure that there's alignment in the investment that we make so that we avoid duplication and so we can create scale. Because unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, because it has an impact on environmental, on climate change and emissions. Shipping lines are now using these super large vessels. And in fact, it's not just an issue on the containers only. Even the vessels that are now for bulk commodities are getting even bigger, which means that they prefer large ports which have huge capacity as opposed to the smaller ports where they run the programs now. Having said that, the real opportunity also arises that if there's a move towards hub strategy where the super large ports, is that the smaller ports are now finally able to find some life, because what happens is that the distribution from the large ports is now also affected by small shipping lines, and it's really smaller vessels that move commodities from one port to the other port. So we watch as those developments arise, but as Bessie's indicated, we will collect the data and revert and review and revert on that one. Bessie, you do want to move on. Nungulago and Andrew, I think in some ways, the stuff maybe for the Honourable Honour, when you come to the issue of SPVs, these are just the structures that we're setting up for the convenience of when we are forming a partnership with the private sector in a particular area. So the SPV that you raised in terms of PA2 as well as NCT, we think that they're absolutely crucial to help us resolve two very somewhat distinct problems. Number one, in Tier 2, Durban has got to, we've got to improve its ranking in terms of performance. That's a fact. And so one of the challenges that we have, and I think I'll tie you back with the issue of gearing, number one, but also, which is an area that Jabu Mdaki, who's the CEO of TPT, has been working on, is sorting out our, in fact, it's TPT working with TE, Translate Engineering, sorting out what is our maintenance practice and protocols of transit so that we don't get to the situation where port equipment is so badly damaged, as is the case. That's number one. Number two, there's also just a very real fact that if you're running a terminal that's supposed to have, for example, Cape Town, it's supposed to contain, Cape Town Container Terminal, it's supposed to be a three-berth operation. It requires us to have nine ship-to-shore crates. Now, we still don't have nine, we have eight at this stage, but we're in the process of moving one towards the Western Cape. In fact, we should actually be having 10 and not 9, because if you have a proper maintenance schedule at any given time, one must be out for maintenance so that you can have reliability assured. So that's where we are moving towards. We're nowhere near there. But at least in as far as the plan to move in that direction, we're quite far in terms of that. So what does the SPV help us? In Tier 2, which is actually our premier container terminal, we need to quickly get to that point where we have the right number of equipment available, operating optimally, and then we have also the redundancy that's necessary so that as one goes up to maintenance, we are able to maintain exactly the right number of cranes that are necessary for a fully functional port. So that's what the partnership in PN2 helped us solve, which is an operational issue, and I suppose a funding issue to get to the right amount of equipment that we need for an efficient container terminal. In the case of Nuka, the partnership is intended to get us volumes, and I think Betty was absolutely clear that actually we should be getting to 2 million TEUs. We've invested to 1.5 million TEUs. We're only just at north of, in fact, because of COVID, we fell below the 50% mark, but we've often only been at 50%. We really need to get a partner who controls cargo. Initially, I suppose, for transshipment, but our view is that if the municipality of Kodesa and CDC were able to position themselves as real manufacturing bases, we might be able to attract the kind of cargo that actually goes towards the just-in-case manufacturing that I was referring to, so that there's greater value added and more jobs that happen in South Africa. So that's what the SPVs are supposed to do. And as far as the separation between TNCA and TPT, what we have done, and I think the question came up about the board of TNCA, we've got three board members who have been appointed as members of the board of TNCA. It's Professor Mufumadi, Ms. Pacheka,
as well as Mr. Bonzela, the chair is Professor Mufumadi of TNPA. We as executives, and in fact, one of the issues that we're working to resolve is the issue of our company, the head of legal will know the legal terminology of a conflict. I'm going to use that word. Maybe it's not even quite the right legal word, but of a conflict between the 2006 Port Act and the 2008 Companies Act, which actually supersedes the Port Act, where there needs to be alignment with the Port Act with that dimension. Number one, which would then enable us to properly form TNPA as a subsidiary of Transnet. I mean, we cannot repeat this as many times enough, actually, that TNPA has to be seen in form and content to be 100% subsidiary of Transnet under the control of Transnet. So we're quite far in the MOIs that we've drafted, but our MOI requires that there's a resolution of this conflict between the Companies Act and NPA so that it can be effective. Once effective, we've basically, as Transnet, worked in the governance structure that would ensure that there would be consistency right into the future in how group governs or oversees the subsidiaries when they establish it. So the ultimate intention is not only to have three board members, but also to have three executive members as members of the board so that we can ensure that there's always alignment in the strategy of the entity as well as the strategy of Transnet. But this is work in progress and it's progressing well. But just for assurance, the issue that we needed to deal with was to ensure that there was no bias in the decisions that TNPA takes relative to TPT. We can assure you, at least from the group level, is that we've been absolutely clear that we do not interfere in the administrative decisions that TNPA has to take with regard to every single terminal operator, not only TPT, everyone. TPT, inclusive of private sector terminal operators, because something we often forget, that there are actually about 98 licenses in South Africa, and we only have 60, at least in terms of the containers, those that we have directly ourselves. I don't know, Bessie, if you want to come in at that point, just to in terms of how you're affecting the governance, but hopefully, members, we could proceed. Yes, Bessie?
Thank you very much, Tupi. And Chair, we've gone about, if I just stick to the question of underperformance by TNPA, I think, Chair, the TNPA's underperformance has been pervasive in what I'll call the port system, and is not limited to, if you like, the divisions of Transnet. To the extent that we are the ones who license terminal operations, and we do that in terms of terminal agreements, conditions of which we should be monitoring and ensuring that those conditions are in fact honored. We will find that we have, if you like, we've got a lot of room for improvement in how we have actually been discharging that particular function. Insofar as performance thresholds, that would be the conditions of the award. Where those performance thresholds had not been met by all terminal operators, there's been very minimal, if any, action that has actually been taken to enforce the conditions. Obviously, failure of those particular conditions, meeting those conditions, would adversely impact on the competitiveness rating of the port system. What I think, Chair, needs to be emphasized is that often when people talk about the underperformance of the port, that is assumed to mean underperformance of TNPA. But to the extent that there's a very clear separation between TNPA as the entity in terms of the act that is charged with the core responsibility of a landlord function, marine services, regulatory and compliance functions, is to provide infrastructure that is fit for purpose and ensure that the port is operated safely insofar as bringing the vessels in and also taking those vessels out. Also, the maritime equipment would be critical in that respect, as well as ensuring that there's compliance to the applicable rules, and there would be many of those. So generally, when we talk about competitiveness of the port, it also talks to the extent to which the terminal operators are in fact performing on a competitive basis. And I'm going to be linking the questions, because there was a question of the performance, for instance, of the Port of Durban relative to other ports. Indeed, Chair, in the competitiveness ranking, we are embarrassingly low, even as it relates to the African continent. We are, in fact, lagging behind. We are no more sitting at the apex of that competitive positioning. And also, if you look at the levels of investments that have actually been poured in these other ports, you will find that there's been significant attention that has been paid by other countries. And indeed, an honorable member, we do visit these particular ports to try and benchmark what we're actually doing. Our colleagues have been to Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, to Benin, within to Namibia, Mozambique, Mombasa. So there is a constant benchmarking and also looking for what we would call a competitive best foot forward, so that we compete with best in our division, because there would be a different division as it would be the case in boxing. But if you do look at the Port of Durban, because the question that was asked by Honorable Modise was the around the ship turnaround time, we are performing very badly. If you look at the benchmark, which is about for the ship turnaround time, which is about 50 hours, we are at the moment in the last quarter, in the last three quarters of 2021-2022, we were sitting, in particular quarter three, we were sitting at 93, and in quarter four, we were sitting at 97. Obviously, quarter two, we would have been adversely impacted by the social upheaval. We went up to 114, which was close to 2.5 the time that we needed to take to have less than half the time for us to actually keep up. The other one in which we're actually underperforming is in the anchorage hours. We're also underperforming. We should also be performing just a tad below 50. And we, in the last quarter, for instance, we're sitting at 74. The average for the year of last financial year was 90. The same with the marine service delay. We are performing a little bit better on best productivity. It should be sitting around 56, and we sit at about 42 moves per hour. And the same with the ship working hour. The target is supposed to be about 65, and we are sitting in the average of about 45 moves per hour. We have focused on the underperformance around the three areas that we talked about. We have renegotiated the performance agreement with the terminal operator. We have instituted a penalty and an incentive system, not without unhappiness on their part, but this is something that we are working on quite significantly. So why are the ports, and that's a question that was asked by Honorable Ngwenya, why are the ports in the West Coast and in the North Northern Hemisphere overperforming compared to where we are at? It's two issues, if I might propose respectfully, Honorable Ngwenya. It's one, investment. The propensity of our country to wait until it's too late and only then to try and hurry with investment, time over and again across sectors, is proven to be a fatal flaw. We would recall the freeways that were closed, and then there was a major upgrade of the freeway to reduce the time, average time it would take for you to drive from the airport, let's say, to Pretoria. So we need to get into a mindset that economic infrastructure is a necessary condition for economic development. Nobody is arguing that it is a sufficient condition, that only if you do it, then everything is going to happen. But the proposition is that if you don't do it, nothing is going to happen. And sometimes you'll never know if it would have happened if you didn't have it. And those countries, as well as companies that are able to exploit the cycles, are companies that actually develop productive capacity when the tide is down. And when the demand pitches up, then they are able to exploit that. In fact, in the coal business, it has just proven to be precisely correct. And that is the argument in economic infrastructure. And the ports are no different from that particular argument. So one of the major causes has been under investment in these ports. Is it because that money was, in fact, being repatriated and to be used elsewhere within the Transnet division? The evidence that we've looked at shows something different. It shows that it is due to complete underperformance by ourselves as TNA. It is sheer lack of delivery. There was never a strategic intent, at least from the evidence, that money would be repatriated elsewhere. But once a budget of 3 billion rand has been approved and you only use 500 million rand, the consequence of that is that for that money would be put to good use elsewhere, but not as a strategic intent, but rather as a consequence of underperformance of TNP. So we are finding that we're having to spend a lot of time in the institutional development and ensuring that the culture is the one that
recording
is
stopped
to development. So
recording
I want
in progress.
To ask what the difference has been from a performance point of view between the rest of the other ports as well as our South African system. We were not monitoring and ensuring that the performance at the terminals were performing to target, and consequence management in the event that they were not performing. Ourselves as an institution, we were not performing, in particular as it relates to investment in infrastructure. That then became a barrier to the type of a client and cargo that would require the type of vessels that we actually need. And if I might just go back to the question of who are our stakeholders? There was a question from Honorable Mwen. We've got a detailed list of stakeholders. And because each port has got what is called a port consultative committee, which is a statutory requirement from our legislation, and all of the stakeholders, and these would be the shipping liners, the shipping agents, the client representative bodies, those would be like people who might be in the citrus fruit industry, and they've got the formal association across these particular disciplines, the logistics representative association, and all of these particular stakeholders find expression in these port consultative committees, and ultimately there is a national port consultative committee. And it is a legal requirement that they must be consulted on a formal basis. And ultimately, that particular statutory body, if I might use that particular term, would then make recommendations to the Minister of Department of Transport. As I indicate, Chair, that we pay particular attention to stakeholders, not just on the basis of their size or influence, but what is important for us is the substantive issue that they actually raise, so that we're able to pay attention to each of those issues that would have a significant impact on the outcome of the work that we actually do. I think on so far as priority to the number seven, Honorable Mwai, is that yes, in terms of achieving a better a continent, we are in fact in the strategic partnerships that we are actually forged, that includes for the neighboring countries like Namibia and Mozambique, we're looking at partnerships, ensuring that in so far as acquisition of type of capability that requires a lot of capital, like dredgers, that we are able to acquire collectively, that insofar as, for instance, the type of machinery, even on the terminal side, which would be outside of TNPA, that if it is possible that the common type of machinery is actually acquired to enable any of the inventory, which would be the stores, so that maintenance of this particular equipment is much easier, and the stores, the pool from which the stores can, the spare parts can actually be drawn, so that you reduce the downtime. So there is a strategic intent and action that is actually being taken to ensure that we actually act in concert with the continent in which we are actually located. From a sustainability point of view, we are pursuing sustainability objectives, including diversity, equity, as well as inclusivity, which all of those would be pursued of objectives to make a better life for all. And if I might just move relatively very quickly to the question that the Honourable Chair asked around the sense of transformation. Your Royal Highness, you're very correct in pointing out that there is a significant deficiency in transformation as it plays itself out insofar as the profile of the terminal operators and the leases that we actually have in place, notwithstanding the fact that the Act itself prescribes that we must achieve at a minimum level of level 4. But we think that that is completely inadequate and insufficient for the strategic objective of our country. So the starting point is to admit right up front that where we are, whilst it might be complying with the legislation as it actually says, but by far doesn't even go halfway to where we think a sustainable, inclusive South African nation should actually be looking at from an economic profile point of view. So part of what we are actually doing in the renewal of the leases, which was one of the significant underperforming areas, it basically up to now gave or takes up to 2 years before we actually award a terminal license agreement, by which time, or a lease agreement, by which time a particular investor has been operating on a month-to-month, and they don't know whether they should invest or they shouldn't invest. And the other one who thought that because the other lease was coming to an end and they have a vested interest, they don't know whether they should retain the capacity that they would have prepared so that they can exploit that particular opportunity. So insofar as creating business confidence and business predictability and certainty, we were doing the exact opposite of that. So from a transformation point of view, we're using the opportunity availed by the leases that are expiring to look at a transform, and one of those is in the island view, which is the heartland of the liquid area in the fuel industry, but across the port system. It is an area that we're going to be reporting on quite hard. In some instances, what that means is a much greater engagement with a business sector to enable the communities from previously disadvantaged to have a much better state of readiness so that we don't take them by surprise when these opportunities are actually advertised, because by when often you don't have the tax certificate, the resources have not been mobilized, the finances have actually not been sorted out, and it is too late, even if you afford a month or so for people to actually mobilize to be able to exploit these particular opportunities. That includes ensuring access to the terminal, as you correctly pointed out. GCE, my sense is I've covered the ones that I think are relevant to me. If there's something that I've missed, I'll be quite happy to come back to it. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
So I think to my mind, Debbie, you seem to have covered everything. Can I just close on this one? I mean, auto is really very important for all of us. At present, we have three ports that move autos: Durban, East London, and Port Elizabeth. There are a lot of changes that we've introduced, actually, in terms of how we manage the auto terminals. TPT have appointed one single manager, and that's Wandi Sabazi, who is now responsible for all of the auto terminals. And we felt that it was really important that we move in that direction so that there would be consistency in the business model and the operating model that we did to maintain right across the system and not have a patchwork of models across the system. So that, number one, is really important. Number two, our primary export port for vehicles will remain there. Well, obviously, reason. The shortest distance between Gauteng and export route is the container route, which is from Gauteng through to the port. Now, we are hopeful that we might be able to increase the number of vehicles that we move on rail and not only on road, but be that as it may, at the port side, what we're wanting to do is to ensure that we have a streamlined, efficient process so that we can be able to achieve the same turnaround time that they're able to achieve in the world. Number one, in some of the, in fact, with the ports with which we compete. Because the point that Betty was making, I think, is really crucial. is that the idea that we be compared to anyone and every single one in the world does not make sense. It is important that the comparator ports are the ports that we know actually they have the sector. So for example, a tough competitor for us, and it's not because we want to drop the argument, it's really tough competitor for us is Port of Thailand. And it's important that as the port, we compare ourselves to Thailand, because when the OEMs in South Africa bid against projects, one of the most difficult areas for them to beat is the competitiveness of Thailand. So we need to directly contribute towards that. So that's number one. The other, though, we've been talking to the industry, is that saying we must improve the throughput. Ports are not storage points, and for too long in transit, we have allowed that. But I suppose it's a reflection of having excess capacity. We have allowed companies, exporters and importers, to use that as point of storage. Ports are supposed to be throughput. The port is supposed to get it, keep it for the shortest time possible, move it out, either exporting it or importing it and moving it to final destination. So that we've been clear about. And the same we've made very clear to the OEM is that we're no longer keeping vehicles at the port. If it's longer than a minimum specified period, we're going to start charging significantly more so that they too can change their behavior on the other side. Now that's crucial, because the minute you change your performance, you suddenly discover that there's no need to expand capacity anyway for storage of vehicles, neither in East London nor in at the port in Port Elizabeth, excepting in Durban, where we do have to make the operations a lot more efficient. And there's quite a lot of work that's been done. Honourable members, I mean, there were some questions that the honourable member Wenya asked, which weren't entirely clear to me, but I'm hoping that in Pepe's answering, he may have covered most of those areas. But I'm not sure, Honourable Chair, we will wait to hear if the honourable members are comfortable with the answers that we've provided. Thank you.
Ms. Boshi, are you done?
Yes, Chen. Sorry, I thought you had. Yes.
Thank you very much. I thought maybe you were still breathing. So I was waiting for the moment wherein you were to say that that's it, Chair, we are done with our questions. No, thank you very much for the questions. As I had indicated that there was an honourable member who had a question, who had raised a hand, and I see that the honourable one now is back. He must have been ejected by the system. Honourable Malengu, you are welcome, and please just raise your question. We did recognize you, but you are not there at a time when we gave you an opportunity. This is the time for you now to take the stage.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members and our transport colleagues and the Department of Public Enterprises colleagues that are attending. My name is Constance Malejo. Should I have my video on?
Yes, please.
Okay, my name is Constance Malejo. I'm the Acting Chief Director in the Transport Department of Public Enterprises. Chairperson, I'm in my school uniform. I'm not in my normal clothing. Please don't be surprised. I did raise my hand earlier on to apologize for the DG of Public Enterprises. But the chair could not recognize me. The DG is not in the meeting. He's held up at another meeting, and I apologize for raising the apology late in the meeting. I just needed to, if chair allows me, can I just respond to the question that was asked on the TNPA? The CEO, the GCO touched on it, but I just wanted to add some information. May I go ahead, Chair? Honourable Chair? Honorable Chairperson, may I go ahead? Okay, I wanted to add on the question that was asked on the TNPA board, whether the TNPA has a board. The board is still interim at the moment. The interim board was extended again on the 25th of May by the minister, and the permanent board will be appointed once the process for the subsidiarization is completed. And the board still has three members. It's Professor Sidney Mufumadi, Professor Louis Bonzena, and Ms. Dimakato Matsuha. And I also just wanted to comment in terms of, you know, the content of the presentation of Transnet. The issue of funding has become quite serious, and the department is working continuously with the Transnet just to try and see how we can resolve the issues, because the landscape has changed. For us to improve the competitiveness of Transnet, some things need, you know, to change, because competitiveness does depend on infrastructure, and we're doing that both on the side of the rail and on the port side. But I also just wanted to mention that as all of these things are being planned, the investments are being planned, there is an importance required of consulting with stakeholders. The department and ministry continuously consults with the industry. And I also want to mention that labor also is an important element, and I know that the Transnet does consult with them, you know, so that the process goes ahead smoothly. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Malehu, and I will now hand over again to Mrs. Poshia to deal with the issues that you are raising. Mrs. Poshia, can you please assist? I'm sorry that we are moving you backward and forward, but because of the network issues, some are located in rural spaces, others are affected by load shedding and so on and so forth. So please can you tackle that question and the comment?
Honourable Chair, I think that wasn't a question to me, that was a statement. That's Constance is in the Department of Public Enterprise, so it's not she's not a member of the committee. So I think she was just supporting some of the statements, the answers that we were providing. Thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thank you for that. I am also in the same position here of the unstable network, so I couldn't hear some of the things that she was saying. But thank you for that. Honourable members, that is the answers as well as the responses which have been made in relation to the comment. I'm not sure if the members still have follow-up questions or second bite on what has been said. I will look into the platform and see if members have got further things. Or you can assist me, Amanda, there, if there are members who have raised further hands. I don't see any hands on my side.
No, there are no further hands.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Poshia, I want to express my sincere gratitude to you as well as Dr. Silinga for having taken us through this presentation. We really appreciate and we sincerely hope that all the things that have been stated here, you will be able to meet the targets. And this expansion is quite needed in the post-COVID economic trajectory that we are seeing, wherein we expect a lot of recovery. And Transnet plays a key role in the economy of our country. We have moved Transnet from being a shelter employment organization into a business that is helping the country to move forward,
but in the same vein, create jobs. These projects must ensure that they play a very significant and a meaningful role in the triple challenges that are facing our economy and our country, especially the job creation. Because when you invest in infrastructure, you create an opportunity for more jobs. And this is what we expect from your good office, from your organization in particular, because it is one of the major institutions of our economy. And we have got full confidence in you with your experience to lead your team in this direction. Also, the experience that is entailed in the leadership of Ndadepe Disilinga is expected us to lead exactly us in that direction, which we expect. These expansions are very key and strategic. We don't want to rely just in one port as a country, because that is very dangerous and it is a recipe for a disaster. If any disaster happens, then the country is completely blocked. So we like this expansion in Ruka, in East London, and elsewhere. And we would want to, in the near future, to get a sense as well of what is happening in the Western Cape, because a lot of movement from the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean of major and massive shipments are taking place in that equation. It would be great to hear what is happening at that level in future engagement. So that being said, we want to really thank you and wish you all the best. We want now to release you. Thank you so much. Unless you have one thing to say before you leave, but on our side, we are covered with what we expect.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Have a good day. Thank you.
Okay. Kamau, yes, yani kulula ke ngoku kakuhle nibuyele emsebenzini.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Honorable members, we will remain on the platform to consider one item before we close the meeting. And that is the item that relates to the minutes of the previous meeting. Let's just give the team from DPE an opportunity to leave. Amanda, have they all left?
They are still leaving, Chief.
Okay, we'll give them just 1 minute to leave the room.
They have all left, Chair.
Honorable members, now the item is relates to the minutes of the previous meeting. Those minutes were shared with us in advance prior to this meeting. If members have got some corrections to make from those minutes, additions, as they are being screened, they can indicate. Otherwise, if there is nothing material that members want to add, I will be asking for a formal adoption of these minutes. Any issue that members wish to highlight for correction in the minutes? No one is raising the hand. Any mover for the adoption of the minutes?
Chair, this is BBE. Yeah, I move for the adoption of the minutes, Chairperson. Thanks.
Honorable Mama, BBE moves for the adoption of the minutes. Any seconder?
You know, Honorable Mudise, seconder, Chair.
Honorable Modise has seconded the adoption of the minutes. Do we have any different view?
No, Chair.
No.
Chair.
There is no different view. The minutes are duly adopted. Honorable members, those minutes now are part and parcel of the legacy of this committee as duly adopted. I want to take this opportunity to appreciate your presence in the meeting and thank you very much for the deliberations and the comments that you have made. And I think it was quite a very fruitful meeting. And allow me to thank you, members, and also release you as you go about to do your work this afternoon. Wishing you a wonderful afternoon, and we'll see you in the plenary. Thank you so much. The meeting is duly concluded. We are adjourned until further notice. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Baba.
Thank you, Chairperson.